Good evening. James McCanny here with my Science Hour, September 9th, 2010, going right into the show. And tonight I want to do something we all should do, on a regular basis, and that is step back and take a look from a distance at what is going on, where we are. This past week I was doing some house cleaning, and it's amazing what I found. Things from 10, 15, and sometimes even 20 years ago. Things that are now relatively useless. Some electronics textbooks, if any of you remember the VME series bus or the Motorola 68000 chip, and there were some Intel matching designs at that time, but very long time ago. Yeah, those books, certainly museum pieces, if anything. But just cleaning out gave me the belief, the thought, that life is somewhat like that. We carry a lot of baggage around that shouldn't be there, and it just burdens us down. And society is like that. We have so much baggage, and then people want to build more roads, more infrastructure, when we cannot take care of what we've already gotten built, what we've built already, or the idea that the number of cars we build every year should be an indicator of our success, or the number of new housing starts. That's really not a measure of accurate measure of wealth or well-being anymore. It really is a situation where the more houses we start now, it simply means the more resources that are being taken, wood and other materials. And you look at some place like Detroit, where they're actually bulldozing whole areas of the central inner city because it has simply been abandoned to the point where it's no longer viable, and the houses just sitting there, people going in and ripping out the wiring for the copper or the tubing in the house, the plumbing for the copper, trying to sell it. So they simply had to bulldoze this area. And let's put it this way, planning has not been a big part of our society. The goal, that drive to get more, to earn more, to get a higher salary, to, you know, for taxes to go up, to, you know, for all of the things that are going on are just simply out of control, and the society cannot function. It's not a planned society. That's the point. So anyway, tonight I'm going to take a little bit of a step back, and from a scientific perspective, I'm going to dive a little bit into the middle of the Diamond Principle, the book. There's a chapter in there, chapter nine, called Turning the Magic Key, and I'm going to use that as a takeoff for some scientific analysis of society today. But at the core of all of this, and something I repeat in my book over and over again, is the absolute necessity of the leaders of the world to promote and maintain bad science and astronomy. Something that is absolutely important. That's why you have all of the glossy magazines and the glossy TV shows, TV specials, Discovery Channel, Discovery Magazine, the History Channel, the National Geographic Science specials. And I want to be real specific, because a lot of the National Geographic travel information is excellent, and their photography and bringing you the world in pictures has always been a great hallmark of National Geographic, but their science follows the party line of government science, and that's something that really is keeping the public down. Just the idea that, with the idea of a space program was going to send a couple people to the moon in the next maybe 15 years. What a waste, what a complete waste of time, of resources, when there's nothing really gained as far as knowledge of living in space, how long can you continue to take everything into outer space from Earth manufacturing? And as I point out in the Diamond Principle, isn't it ridiculous that people sitting in an office, engineers or scientists or planners, in an office in California or Texas or Maryland or wherever they might be, these people planning what it should be like to be in outer space, and these are people who have never been in outer space, never will be in outer space. How can you have a space program designed by people who have never been there, who have no clue, and the way they can do it, of course, is to build an entirely artificial environment and put people up there and then ship everything to them as if they were eating supper at home or is close proximity of the type of activities we have here. But there's no learning going on regarding living in outer space. So it's just a money-making, another government program, very ill-directed, and with no overall directive, no overall sight of where we want to be. And the first thing that we should be looking at in outer space is a body of the type of spacecraft that would be used up there for moving large numbers of people up there on a semi-regular basis, not a permanent basis yet. But it's a learning curve. How can you have a space station with no artificial gravity? It looks like a bunch of soup cans hooked together in space. And the idea that there's no artificial gravity, which is very easy to produce, if you just take you take two tin cans in space, connect them with a string, and start them spinning, and you have gravity. You have artificial gravity. How hard is that? But nothing like that being done at all with the current space station program, or with any of the other programs. The point is, there's no planning. There's no overall objective. It's just like, oh, well, let's go to the moon again. After what? Decades and decades, send another little bit larger craft to the moon? What an absurd objective. Absolutely absurd, but look at who thought it up. This is done by people who couldn't even manage a popcorn stand. So, at any rate, the Earth is in a turmoil right now because of the leadership, or the lack of leadership, but following these directions that are very old. I get a kick out of the politics now where they're saying, oh, the Republicans should come up with a plan so they can counter what the Democrats are doing. This is the old dog and pony show, like if you just wait till the next election, maybe there'll be hope. I got news for you. It ain't going to change no matter who is elected. So I don't want to go into politics, but the point is, the main point is that science should be directing Earth. There should be scientists coming out and saying, we need a overall direction here for Earth. What's our most important goal as a human race? And start with that. Is it having eternal wars and bickering and race wars and ethnic wars and all of the selling arms in the black market? All of these things are going on, and it's like nobody can stop this. Nobody can put the brakes on all of this. And as the politicians go off to Washington, all they can do is vote and support it. So it's just an amazing situation where the Earth and the inhabitants of Earth have absolutely no control. But anyway, so I'm going to take a little bit, that's the negative side of it. What I'm going to do is take a bit of the positive side and talk about where we should be. And it's really an analysis based on scientific understanding of the universe. How can we utilize the universe? What exists in the universe to allow us to to allow us to use this universe to our benefit and have an easy, simple lifestyle, something that is just not considered. How has nature designed this universe for our ease of use? But first, I'm going to go into a couple, quite a few topics actually I have to talk about here before the end of, before going into the main science topic. Here's a study that just came out, was released about a week ago, talking about the Trojan asteroids. Now, these are large asteroids associated with Jupiter. They happen to be in like a gravitational loop with Jupiter. And before, they were believed to be associated with what are known as the Kuiper objects. These are the objects, like, for example, Pluto is now considered a Kuiper object, or any of these small minor planets that are outside the orbit of Neptune. So quite a ways out in the solar system. But now it was originally believed, it is called the Nice model, where they believed that these objects were moved to where they are by the gravitational influence of Saturn and Jupiter. But now studies are showing that no, that's probably not the case because of the orbital inclination and other characteristics. So for more than about 4,000 of these objects, they simply don't know where they came from. All they know is that they did not form where they are right now. And so anyway, I just want to mention this because every time a new study comes out, it seems to contradict the old, leave a puzzle unsolved for scientists who work in these fields, and leave them with no answers. But the answer is very clear, that all of these objects have come into the solar system by capture, one at a time. These are it's a very simple process gravitationally. You need two gravitational bodies, the Sun and Jupiter, the Sun and Saturn, the Sun and Earth. It could be Jupiter and Earth. It could be Saturn and Earth. Some type of coupling between two gravitational bodies. But what happens is there is a energy reduction, a loss of momentum as an object comes in, and it becomes trapped. It loses energy. And the same process is used in reverse all over the place. Engineers use this constantly to fling satellites out into the into outer space and to gain energy. So that's the reverse of this process. And so the capture involves two things. First of all, the pair of celestial objects and their gravitational fields. And then it requires an object coming in from outside to come in just right, this doesn't always happen that objects are captured, but on a high enough percentage basis that, sure, we're gonna have thousands and thousands of objects in this solar system that have been captured over time. So the point is that the Trojan asteroids were captured, just like almost all of the planets in the solar system, all of the moons, and that's an essential part of my comet theory, is that comets are captured also. They're captured objects, they come into the solar system, they lose that initial energy, then they become an orbiting part of the solar system, discharging the solar capacitor and losing more energy as the tail drag causes them to circularize their orbit and become permanent members of the solar system. And as this is happening, there's always the chance of collisions or near misses. So at any rate, the point is that scientists once again discover that in the case of the Trojan asteroids, these objects could not possibly have formed where they are. They came from someplace else, they don't know where, and so what does that tell you? Did they all come at one time? No, of course not. They all came separately, individually, which implies capture. So, not too hard to figure out, but see, that's where scientists, the Tier 2 scientists, can't go. They cannot go there because that would raise some questions. Well, if you can capture those objects, how about new planets? gee, Velikovsky might have been right. You see that immediately you get the contradictions that lead to the right conclusions, but they can't go there. They can't talk about that. They cannot get to those correct conclusions. So they have to keep looking for that mysterious mechanism that got all those Trojan asteroids in close to Jupiter, but without using the word capture. Because it just leads to that immediate question. If you could capture 4,000 Trojan asteroids, how about a nice big comet? How about a big comet nucleus that eventually would become a planet? See, they can't go there. They can't go past first base once they make these discoveries. But I can go there. I don't never took money from the government and never lived under that monopoly science that drives what you hear. But then just imagine how this influences what the public sees. The public then would start to ask questions. It's just like the demoting of Pluto as a planet. They had to do that, because if not, all of a sudden we were going to have 40 more planets. And the obvious question the public would ask is, well, you know, all through grade school, high school, college, whatever, I was told there were 9 planets, and Pluto was the farthest planet. And all of a sudden there's 40 planets? Where did those come from? And then are there more? Are there more bigger ones? Are there other ones that could come into the solar system and wreak havoc here? It just immediately goes to those basic questions that the public would certainly be intelligent enough to ask. So that's why they can't even begin to go there. They have to maintain this facade that somehow everything was created at once and life is good. And they can keep repeating that. But the obvious result of their own studies shows that that is very much not the case. Capture of these objects individually, one by one, over a long period of time, and then bringing them in, and they are distributed through the solar system. That is what causes the solar system to appear the way it is today. Capture. Another little story here. This came out once again about a week and a half ago. Talking about computer memories. There's a new type of computer memory that's being developed, and it's probably about a year or two away from commercial marketing. They have to test the reliability of these memories, because computing right now is fairly reliable. Millions, if not billions, of exercises, even in your home computer, happening every second, and all of these have to happen accurately. If there's one missed bit in there, if a zero turns to one or a one to zero, it could mess up the entire process. So, and it would, because everything has to be very orderly. So, would the memories be commercially viable on a large scale? And so that's the question. So they're working on that right now. But the point is that the memories would have a much denser, information capacity. And they work, as it is said, much more like the human brain, where synapses and connections and logical connections hold the information. So the point is that as computers develop, sometimes the screens develop much more rapidly. Sometimes the memories develop much more rapidly, and sometimes the hard drives would be developed more rapidly. Sometimes the processors develop more rapidly, but there's this constant struggle to keep everything at somewhat the current rate, somewhat the current capability, so you can build a matching system. So when one part improves, that automatically improves another part of the system and possibly even calls for a better design. For example, an increase in memory might cause an increase in screen density, because now you have more information to throw up onto the screen and become visible and become legible. It might have an implication in terms of what is known as the GUI, the user interface. And that's the interface that you see. That's what's on the computer screen, and you're clicking with your mouse to activate certain functions or whatever. That's the GUI. That's the user interface. So it could cause an increase in the user interface, a streamlining, a more efficient design, possibly human communication, talking to a computer, or listening to computer responses and then discussing this with a computer. And those, of course, already exist. You can call up, and a lot of times banking is a good example, or sometimes insurance companies, where you call up and you're interacting with a voice, and based on what you say, there's voice recognition, and the computer then is able to make discussions with you, carry on discussions, based on your answers. So anyway, the improvement in memories would possibly bring on some other types of improvements in computing in general. It's said that memories in computers are reaching their limit as far as the amount of density of information you can put into a certain area on a disk, on a DVD, or in a computer memory, the hard memories, the solid state memory, so to speak, those are reaching a limit to where they just can't make them any smaller or put any more information in them. So at any rate, there's a new style of memory that could have you see on the market one of these days, but as I said, reliability seems to be a big factor. I'm going to quick go into a little bit on the hurricane season this year. I got a kick out of this, that once again this past week, the Hurricane Prediction Center had to lower their numbers, their prediction numbers. Now, let me just say something. When I make a hurricane season prediction at the beginning of the year, I don't go in somewhere in the middle, if it isn't turning out right with what I said. I don't go in the middle of the season and say, well, we're going to adjust the numbers here to match what's going on. And I think that's absurd, because if you have a predictive model, then it should predict. You shouldn't be allowed to go back in and modify it and change it and say, well, now we think this, or now it's going to be less. You really shouldn't be able to do that. So they are downgrading the hurricane prediction for this year. But this is what I get a kick out of. Listen to this article. This is out of Bloomberg webpage. They do economic analysis. There are groups now selling bonds. Basically, they're called catastrophe bonds. And you buy them based on the amount of activity that you would expect over the next, for example, in this case, the hurricane season. So there are people who are betting that there is going to be a big hurricane season, and of course, when the National Predictive Hurricane Center comes out and makes a prediction like this is going to be a banner year for hurricanes, then those stock markets go up. And so people make money by investing in these, hoping that a hurricane will come and do a lot of damage, and then the places where there is damage will have to come out and borrow money. So they're betting on that process, that they're betting on the catastrophe or the hardship of people out there to make money. But what's interesting this year is, based on the original prediction by the National Hurricane Prediction Center of this banner hurricane year, the stock, the bonds for these catastrophe bonds sold extremely well. But now the prices are dropping because it hasn't panned out. Hurricane Earl this past week went up the East Coast and dumped some rain, but it wasn't the major catastrophe that you might expect from a hurricane. All of the other hurricanes have just gone harmlessly out into the Atlantic Ocean. We did have one, I think it was Fiona, that came into southwestern Texas and dumped a lot of rain with some high winds. But that's a Pacific storm. But once again, not what you would call a tremendous storm. not the type we should be seeing in early September or late August, the heart of the hurricane season. What's comical is these groups would invest in these catastrophe bonds, hoping for a disaster. Let's see, what does it say here? That the U.S. Climate Prediction Center cut its forecast to lower numbers due to a slower than expected activity in the first 2 months of the season, when they had predicted that there would be an extremely active season. Well, it's well over half over now, and so we could still get a hurricane, but it would not be indicative of a tremendous hurricane season. In fact, one does expect a couple of hurricanes in the month of August, and that's what we had, but they were very mild. They spun north, and when you see those storms swinging north like that and running up the center of the Atlantic or even up the eastern coast of the United States, those are very weak storms. They didn't have enough strength to pull them across and keep going westerly, being driven by the equatorial electron stream. So at any rate, also the sun has been extremely quiet lately. For the last number of years, it has been extremely quiet. So I get a kick out of some of these shows. They have people on who are imposters, wannabes, and they're all, ooh, this is going to be the biggest solar cycle ever, leading up to 2012, or all of this, these other commentaries. And really, the sun has been the quietest it's been probably throughout much of its history, its recorded history as far as we're concerned, so the last few hundred years when scientists have been able to study the sun. In the last couple of years and the last couple of months have been some of the quietest times for the sun. It's simply a fact. It's not something that's arguable. That the sun count spot for years has been almost zero. And so this, all of these factors combined tell us that the sun has a very low activity level. And what I always thought, and I've said it many times, is that the real increase in activity was due to the comet Hale-Bopp careening through the solar system, or it wasn't really careening through the solar system. It moved through the solar system in around 1995 to the year 2000, and is very much becoming a planet in this solar system. It's just on an orbit that's perpendicular to the orbits of all the other planets, but someday it might encounter Earth, and in doing so, in fact, it's inevitable. It's not sure. It's hard to say if it would happen on the upcoming orbit return in about 2,500 years, or if it might happen on successive returns after that. Very difficult to predict that particular result, because comets have their orbits changed dramatically when they come into the solar system and start discharging the solar capacitor. The tail drag, the orbits of the comets change, especially the bigger ones, the orbits change dramatically. So the point is that getting back to the idea of the solar cycles, the solar cycle has been the lowest it's been probably forever as far as we are concerned. There was the Maunder Minimum, which occurred back in the Middle Ages and caused a mini ice age, and that's when also there were no sunspots. So I think this low activity is a result of the sun being very peaked. It had a double peak back around the year 2000, and I think that is was caused by the presence of comet Hale-Bopp driving up the energy of the sun on a daily basis, and then the cycle back down brought it negative, so to speak, farther than it had been before. And so the energy that we receive here from the sun at planet Earth has been very low. And thus, the rather weak hurricane season, coupled with the fact that there have not been any electrical alignments in the solar system for a very long time. Okay, on to the next subject. And this, I always like to include fan mail here. This one was sent in from Germany. This is from, let me get a name here, Stefan in Germany. And I wanted to point out something. What he sent was some imaging here that is done of the plasmas that surround Earth, magnetosphere simulation and plasma. And one of the pictures has a very interesting plasma configuration. And I want to refer back, first of all, to biblical references. And this is something the ancients talk about regularly. They call it the horns of the bull. Now, we all know what a bull's, I'm not talking about the big Texas type steer, I'm talking about a bull. They're kind of curved and they're rather short, and they're very arcing. They're like an arc, let's put it that way, coming out of each side of the animal's head. And so, those have been referenced throughout history as indicative or a characteristic of the big comets that caused disasters throughout Earth's history. And so the point is that the plasma interactions that have been measured around, this is actually around planet Earth, but planet Earth is very much a comet also, and plasma horns are very visible in these. They extend out from the Earth's magnetosheath out or from the and back in towards Earth. So it's a from our surrounding magnetic field, the plasma sheets coming in are very reminiscent of horns of the bull. And so the reason I'm pointing this out is comets would also have the same type of interaction, especially very large comets. And so that is a physical plasma explanation for a term that comes out of history. It comes out of biblical references, referring to the large comets that had an effect on Earth and the solar system throughout ancient times. The type of big comets we have not seen in recent historical times. But the horns of the bull, so if for those of you who are to looking at Bible studies or other ancient texts, the horns of the bull are constantly referred to, and that refers to the plasma interaction of the object. In the case of Earth, it would be out to our plasma sheath. In the case of a comet, it would be out similarly to the edge of the magnetic field and plasma sheet, but the fluorescence, the lighting, would take on the form of a bull's horns, and thus the reference to the bulls of the horn in terms of ancient, Velikovsky talks about these. And that's what the ancients saw, but they had no real way of describing it. They weren't going to say, well, this is a plasma effect due to Earth's interaction with the local magnetic field. Of course, the ancients weren't going to say that. They were simply going to use descriptive words to tell what they saw. In other words, the horns of the bull. So, at any rate, just wanted to mention that. Very interesting. And this is, once again, to explain where this came from. First of all, the ancient text come from the Bible or other ancient texts that talk about, that describe the large comets that were in the sky throughout history. But the other part of it was these are real-time magnetosphere simulations, and this is from a website actually I think it's out of Japan where the website is located, but the description was sent by a fan, Stefan, from Germany. So at any rate, passing that on to you, the public, because I've always thought that was a very important reference and very telling, because it's very indicative of plasma interactions. Those horns of the bull, or also the in the Mexican or the Inca, the Aztec Inca Maya legends, talking about Quetzalcoatl, the plumed serpent god of the night sky, and they always show him with a very long tongue, and that's the tongue is the plasma discharge sheath on the sunward side. It's the electron sheet fluorescing. And so if you look at Quetzalcoatl, usually with long plumed hair or in the form of a snake and serpent, and there's all types of other configurations, the thunderbird, the all of the different terms or personifications that were used throughout history by the ancients who saw these events. And that leads into an article. It actually appeared in the one of the American Geophysical Union periodicals in the past week. But it's talking about a guy named Sidney Chapman, who was a relatively famous scientist, kind of a leading scientist, back in the early 1800s when they were first starting to try and get a grasp on electromagnetism and activity in from the sun as related to Earth. And they by that time they knew that the sun would have eruptions, and a number of days later those eruptions would affect Earth weather and give us auroras, give us especially light shows up in the atmosphere, the aurora borealis, etc. So at any rate, as the story goes, Chapman did not understand, but he did understand a little bit, enough to imagine that something electrical was going on here. But in his initial papers, the English physicist Lindemann criticized Chapman for what he said. Chapman changed his concept and went along with the idea that no, there could not be any charged electrical activity in outer space. And there are physical reasons for this on a basic level, but let me explain that. That if you had a charged body in outer space, if you could take a charged, electrically charged, either positively charged or negatively charged object, and just put it out in outer space, there's enough free charge out there that it would very quickly come to this object and neutralize it or shield it. And that would balance the charge throughout outer space. But what these people did not realize, and that's something that I had to realize early in my work, was what was the source of this information? The source of these, the activity that we were seeing? And what I absolutely had to come to the conclusion was that that there had to be a differential in the solar wind which caused an electric field, and that was the cause of the electrical powering of our entire solar system. So at any rate, that's something that occurred to me. But I just wanted to point this out, that as early as 1918, there were people like Langmuir, was one of the guys, and then Birkeland and Chapman and Lindemann, and they all were observing these phenomena, aurora and the sun causing solar storms and then therefore causing other kinds of visible effects, especially in Earth's atmosphere. But none of them could cross that line that something electrical was happening in the universe. They just thought that these things were somehow related to neutrality, that there was a neutralness, let's put it that way, to outer space. So Birkeland and Chapman and Lindemann and Langmuir, all of these people could see the onset of geomagnetic storms or aurora borealis, and it related it to the sun. But they all came back to the conclusion that space was electrically neutral. And that's where the problem was. That's where the problem is today, And that's what I try to work on and try and promote the idea that no, this is not a neutral universe. And the reason it isn't is because you have a very powerful fusion star in the center, and that fusion star is producing a charge differential, and that's what causes the battery that causes all of our weather, all of our severe weather, causes all of our weather. If it weren't for that, we wouldn't have a vertical electric field on Earth. We wouldn't have the clouds form. We'd have very bland weather. So it's a very essential part, although a very subtle part, of our entire solar system makeup. Because gravity, in a sense, rules. Gravity is the primary mover and shaker in the solar system and in the universe. But these electrical effects are very subtle. And that's what my book and work tries to explain, is that these are very important but very subtle, and they only take on a presence in under certain very strange conditions. And that's why you have to be careful, by the way, when you're on the internet looking around and looking at these type of concepts, because there's a bunch of clowns running around the internet that have no scientific background and no understanding of the subtleness of the electrical part of the universe that we live in. It's very subtle, it's very complicated, but it's something you can understand also. Of course, my books talk about that. And by the way, the Diamond Principle, dealing with an analysis of society, basically, also shows the importance of the electrical nature of the solar system and why it's designed that way to make it easy for us to transport in outer space, to put things in outer space, and to follow the pathway to the stars. I call it the highway to the stars, or it's a way of moving, and because nature has put these electrical conditions out there, and if you understand how they work, they can become an essential part of the environment, and we have to understand how to use these. And that's why it is so detrimental to have Tier 2 science. In fact, the Chapman science exists today, and everybody out there follows it to the T. And they've all been educated with this, and it's something I had to break through myself and get out of, especially when I was at Cornell. Everybody there followed Chapman physics. There are a series of lectures that are called the Chapman Lecture Series, and scientists go to these. Try and promote the understanding of especially plasma physics and outer space physics. But they all lack the very fundamental concept that space is not electrically neutral. And so the science today has been, since 1918, since Chapman first started out publishing, and Lindemann and these people who should have been good scientists, they were, and what they did was sound, but they didn't realize one thing, that the battery producing part of this whole electrical setup that causes the plasma, that causes our Earth weather, that causes the weather on Jupiter, that causes comets to discharge the solar capacitor, all of this physics is missing because of one big mistake made back in 1918 by a guy named Chapman and his cohorts at the time. Here's another article that was just sent in recently by another fan. It said, it is now clear that the record low temperature and density, let me just start at the beginning. This is information about solar cycles and global impact. Earth's high atmospheric layer, it says, recently shrunk to a historic low. And so it is now clear that the record low temperature and density were primarily caused by unusually low levels of solar radiation at the extreme ultraviolet level, which is the higher energy part of the spectrum. If it is indeed similar to certain patterns in the past, then we expect to have low solar cycles for the next 10 to 30 years. And then it goes on to say the sun's energy output declined to unusually low levels from 2007 to 2009, and through the prolonged solar minimum and scarcity of sunspots. And it goes on to talk about other effects. But anyway, the point is that scientific measurements are confirming basically what I've been saying, that there's, you know, there are no sunspots, the Earth's temperature has been cooling, but this is a result, a direct result of solar input. It has nothing to do with the greenhouse effect or other factors. So it turns out we could be in for a cooling period, not a warming period, and that's why, of course, the climatologists have switched their story to global conditioning of the atmosphere and don't talk about global warming anymore, because global warming really isn't happening. As right now we're going through a low energy sun, a cooling period, etc. So at any rate, with that in mind, I'm going to go into Chapter 9 from the Diamond Principle. And by the way, this is, if you haven't ordered the Diamond Principle, it's only available on my website, and it's only going to remain available on my website. People would like it to go on to Amazon. I don't trust any of those outlets, so that's all I'm going to say about that. But Chapter 9, this is from the Diamond Principle, my new book just released about a month ago. It says, the title of the chapter, Turning the Magic Key. Now, I'll just do a quick read off the first couple paragraphs. The first 9 chapters of this book were designed to bring about a new reality for the majority of readers. For some, this would be the first time they had heard any of these topics discussed, whereas for others, they may have had an idea that something was not correct in their view of the world, but still needed to be handed the information. There are still others that are well versed in the true ways of the world, which would contain a segment of my radio and book audience who have had a good education into these topics. So basically what I'm saying is the first 9 chapters, first chapters of the book really deal with the educating the public as to like society. It's an analysis of society and a lot of the things going on in society. Okay, so paragraph 2 of Chapter 9, Turning the Magic Key. But now it is time to turn the corner and begin the other side of the Diamond Principle. Anyone attempting to form a bubble group without first understanding the methods and ways of the real world would be like lambs to the slaughter. They would not last the first night out. One might liken this to the understanding of the founding fathers of the United States as they risked their lives to form a new union needed to leave the oppressive governance of the old English Empire. They had to accomplish 2 goals simultaneously. They had to first repel the old and keep it from returning, and secondly, they had to define the future of freedom and liberty and the pursuit of happiness for future generations. In a sense, they turned a magic key. So too, it is with the pursuit of understanding modern society in order to turn the key and begin the future movement of the human species into the freedom of outer space. Okay, so anyway, what I'm saying here is that the second part of the Diamond Principle deals with understanding universal principles and understanding the electrical nature of the universe so that we can use that to our advantage for propulsion, for ease of movement, for power in outer space. All of the things we need in outer space, including the collection of water, of other chemicals, the collection of hydrocarbons that would be used in outer space to refine plastics that would be used to manufacture the spacecraft in outer space to make them much stronger. Maybe you have heard of this, that a piece of aluminum foil made in outer space would be much stronger. Because it doesn't have the impurities, there would be a much purer aluminum manufacturing. So a sheet of aluminum the size of aluminum foil would be extremely strong if it were manufactured in outer space. So, and the same with plastics. Clearly, you want to have a manufacturing process that is easy and builds the space stations, the spacecraft, etc., that you want. And it all has to be accessible from outer space, which it is. But don't ask NASA, don't ask the current space program for anything like that, because they're not, it's simply not in their vision. Everything from our current space program goes strictly, it's all manufactured on Earth, and then it's taken with great pain and great amount of expense with other shuttle launches or other rocket launches, and it is taken up to the space station, where it is used, and then even the garbage has to be brought back. There's no understanding of living in space. And space has a very unique environment. It's electrical, and you can use that electricity for all types of processes in outer space that allow you to function in outer space with ease. And that's the whole point. How can you get to the point where you understand electricity in outer space and its uses if you don't understand it on Earth? So, at any rate, that's why the Diamond Principle is not just about an analysis of society. It's a guidebook for using the simple mechanisms designed into the universe for our benefit. For propulsion, for energy, for attracting materials that we need to build things, for the energy to modify, for example, aluminum or plastic or any of the other materials that you would gather in outer space. And some people might be saying, "Well, how do you get plastic in outer space?" Well, it basically plastic comes from hydrocarbons. One of the molecular forms of hydrogen and carbon, and with other additives, of course, to give it certain properties. But plastic is a very important product in outer space. It's just has so many properties. But the point is the universe has a design, and I just want to refer back to the Stephen Hawking statement of a week ago, and I talked about this on my show a week ago, that Stephen Hawking said there's no God, there's no design needed in science, and nothing could be farther from the truth. There is a design, there is a master design, and it's the same on the far side of the universe as it is here. And so it's very important to understand the Diamond Principle explains those properties of the universe, especially the electrical properties, which are there to make our life easy. So what do? We sit here and I just saw a blog this past week talking about the space shuttle being the most advanced transportation technology ever devised by man. Well, there's a problem here, because chemical rockets will never, ever, ever get us into outer space on the scale that we need. It's extremely expensive. The payload is a small, minute fraction of the rocket that takes off. So you have all of this fuel that you're expending to get a little teeny payload into outer space. What's wrong with that picture? Isn't there an easier, better way? Well, of course there is. But you're never going to see it out of NASA, because their program is to keep the public from getting into space. And that's going to continue. That's going to go on for forever, basically. Because the whole point of NASA, if you look at the top-down control, they don't want people going into outer space. When Dennis Tito and some of the other tourists tried to get into outer space, NASA put up a huge resistance. They didn't want the public up in outer space. They didn't want a guy who was able to afford a $20 million space ride. They did not want him in outer space, and they did everything they could do to prevent him from going there. And once he got up there, nobody from the American side of the space station even talked to him or looked at him. He sat over on the Russian side of the space station drinking vodka and talking to the Russians, and of course he didn't speak Russian, they didn't speak English. So at any rate, why is NASA so opposed to the public going into space? Well, they have a monopoly, and that monopoly would not be well maintained if all of a sudden it was easy for the public to go into outer space. And in large numbers, that would bypass NASA. And so but there's more of a top-down control element that fixes this, so the public simply cannot go into outer space. So the Diamond Principle doesn't end round around this, and it teaches you the basics. It says these are the conditions in the solar system and the universe, and this is how we do things. This is how we gather materials. This is how we make a space station in outer space. Here are the materials. And of course, there's a lot of planning and a lot of work that has to go into this, but if you have a container in space and you have a mechanism of propulsion to move it around, then basically you have a space station. Then you just have to modify the interior design of the spacecraft to be a livable, comfortable area, and that shouldn't be too hard to do, given the ingenuity of man. Also, there's the requirement of sending many, many people into outer space. So I'm talking hundreds of thousands, if not millions of people. And there's very good reasons for this. You need a large cross-section of people just for the genetic pool. A small genetic pool is not a viable genetic pool. It'll weaken in very quickly. The point is that the Diamond Principle is a book that teaches how to live in the universe. What kind of mechanisms are out there? What kind of design is there? And it's very clear that there's a great resistance to allowing that. And so the Stephen Hawking statement that there is no God, there is no design, flies in the face of my book. His statement came a month after my book was out, and there are people who clearly feel that his statement is in direct opposition to what my book is saying, the Diamond Principle, because they don't want that message out there. They don't want the message of hope. At any rate, go to my webpage, jmccsci.com, the mail order address, P.O. Box 58, Navarre, Minnesota, N-A-V-A-R-R-E, Minnesota, 55392. That's $16.90 for one book or two books for $23.90. This is Jim McCanny. This is my Science Hour. And as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.